So with regard to Cuba, refusing to provide the Air Force to support the Bay of Pigs, and refusing to bomb or invade during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and finally working out a diplomatic rapprochement with Cuba, he outraged not only the national security establishment and the liberation milieu, but powerful corporate interests and political interests, related political interests that lay behind them. Policy of detente with the Soviet Union, joint space exploration, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, and the speech he made at American University, regarded very warmly by the Soviet people and government, and also his Vietnam pullout, which he had undertaken, all not only were anathema, but those steps not only didn't represent the fulfillment of rollback or liberation, they were the exact opposite, and had that process continued, it might very well have ended the Cold War, at least thawed it to the point where something remotely resembling normal relations might have been undertaken between the U.S. and the USSR. Obviously, John Kennedy's assassination eliminated that, and what we're going to begin looking at now is we're going to return to this coup. And again, I want to refer people to other archive shows dealing with some of these events. The assassination of John Kennedy was covered in The Guns of November, Parts 1 through 4. It's also covered in Radio Free America shows 10 through 13, primarily 11, 12, and 13, program number 15, as well as information in the first two installments of Radio Free America 37. What we're going to take a look at now is the operation of this rollback or liberation milieu, the same petroleum industry intelligence Galen-related milieu involving a synthesis between some of these Third Reich alumni and the American radical right. We're going to look again at the role of this rollback or liberation milieu, and bear in mind that George Bush was part and parcel to this milieu, and we're going to come back to George Bush personally next week. We're going to take a look again at how this milieu functioned in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy. Now, as I indicated during the introduction to tonight's installment of Radio Free America 37, what we're going to do is begin dollying back. We're going to begin in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas, and we're going to take a look at how some of these White Russian, Galen, petroleum industry-related elements functioned in creating disinformation about the assassination of John Kennedy, and specifically, again, pointing in the direction of JFK's assassination as a Soviet conspiracy, thereby threatening the possibility of World War III, and in the opinion of Peter Dale Scott, necessitating in the minds of some of the investigators a cover-up in order to avoid a Third World War. And we're going to begin in Dealey Plaza, and we're going to take a look at how this milieu functioned, and in particular how they functioned in conjunction with elements of Army Intelligence and Army Intelligence Reserve present in Dealey Plaza, functioning both in the Secret Service and in military and in the Dallas Police Department. And then in three more installments, not of the archive show, but we're going to begin dollying back, and in a sense we're going to move from Elm Street to Wall Street. And this again by way of looking at the powerful political and economic forces which lay behind the rollback or liberation milieu. And this by way of taking a look at how the rollback or liberation milieu, much larger, by the way, much larger at this point than the Galen-related elements with which it began, much, much larger, the liberation milieu, we're going to take a look at the powerful political and economic forces lying behind the liberation milieu. We're going to take a look, again, at the evolution, the functioning of this liberation milieu, this Galen-related petroleum industry intelligence milieu. We're going to begin on Elm Street, so to speak, in Dealey Plaza on 11-22-63. We're going to begin dollying back, and we're going to see how the same milieu functioned in relation to powerful economic and political interests. And ultimately, we're going to move from Elm Street to Wall Street, yet at the same time as we begin examining the effects of the Kennedy assassination on American-based multinational corporate policy, we will at the same time remain very close to the functioning of the intelligence community, because even as we take a look at some of the prime movers and shakers in corporate America and on Wall Street, we will at the same time see how many of them function in connection with the intelligence community. This, again, by way of establishing the macro-political and macro-economic context within which the liberation milieu existed and functioned, and this by way of examining the political and economic forces with which the Galen Organization interacted in order to effect the profound changes on American and world history that it wound up doing. As we take a look at this progression from Elm Street to Wall Street, we will again rely on the brilliant work of Professor Peter Dale Scott of the University of California at Berkeley, arguably the preeminent political intellect in this country at this time. And we're going to begin with Peter Dale Scott's manuscript, Government Documents and the JFK Assassination, from 1972. Now, we're going to return again to this Galen-related petroleum industry intelligence milieu, and we're going to take a look at how two members of this milieu that we've looked at earlier, Peter Gregory and Ilya Mamontov, Gregory and Mamontov, how they functioned in connection with distorting Marina Oswald's testimony about the Mannlicher Carcano rifle supposedly used by Oswald to kill Kennedy, and how these distortions not only indicated prima facie evidence of a conspiracy, but how they were used to help misdirect attention in the direction of a Soviet conspiracy. And again, as Peter Dale Scott has theorized and others before him, that necessitated in the minds of some investigators a cover-up to prevent a Third World War. We already looked at this in the second installment of Radio Free America 37. We begin reading now in Government Documents and the JFK Assassination. Now, bear in mind again that George Bush is part and parcel of this milieu. Whether or not he was involved in the JFK assassination, he certainly, as director of CIA, frustrated congressional investigations of CIA connections to Oswald and Ruby, and his name, Bush's does, crops up in connection with the investigation into JFK's assassination in a number of different contexts, as we've already looked at, and bear in mind that he is front and center. He's deeply involved in this milieu, because we're going to examine the Reagan and Bush administrations next week. But now, returning to government documents and the JFK assassination, we're going to begin on Elm Street in Dealey Plaza, and eventually we're going to wind up on Wall Street. Peter Dale Scott writes, "More specifically, I want to look at certain tiny distortions of Marina Oswald's initial testimony by two emigre Russian interpreters in Dallas, both of whom had known each other for many years, both of whom had worked together to set up a CIA-subsidized anti-communist, quote, church, unquote, in Dallas, and one of whom had known Oswald before the assassination. The distortions in themselves were small, but their implications were potentially very great. We know they occurred because, for some reason, a transcript was prepared by a lone Secret Service a transcript was prepared of a long Secret Service interview of Marina Oswald on November 24, 1963. At a few points, the transcriber noted small deviations between what Marina actually said and what the interpreter, Oswald's friend Peter Gregory, translated. Two of these small deviations, by a strange coincidence, added the same details about Oswald's rifle as were put down in Marina's police affidavit on November 22nd, 2 days earlier, after translation by Gregory's friend, Ilya Mamontov." Again, M-A-M-A-N-T-O-V. Now, of the Mamontov interview, this on 11-22-63, Scott writes, "This, i.e. the alleged murder weapon, was like the rifle my husband had. It was a dark gun, but I don't remember the sight on it." And this was an affidavit by Dallas policeman Senkel, S-E-N-K-E-L, whose name we will come back to later. Again, Marina on 11-22-63. Now, note her statement that it was a dark gun. That's critical here. It'll seem picayune under the circumstances, but it was critical. "This, i.e. the alleged murder weapon, was like the rifle my husband had. It was a dark gun, but I don't remember the sight on it." Ruth Payne, who was present at the first interview, also recalled specifically that Marina, quote, said her husband had a dark gun, dark in color. She couldn't definitely recall the sight, unquote. And Scott goes on to comment, Keeping in mind the consensus as to the underlying details on November 22nd, it is disturbing to learn that on November 24th, these details did not originate with Marina, but with her interpreter. On both points, Marina's testimony was significantly different, enough so to attract the attention of the transcriber. Question. This gun, was it a rifle? Bear in mind, this is on November 24th, 1963. The previous interview, Mamontov was translating, now Peter Gregory is translating. Both petroleum, both white Russians, both part of this milieu, this liberation milieu. Question. This gun, was it a rifle or a pistol or just what type of gun? Can she answer that? Answer. It was a gun. Mr. Gregory asked, can you describe it? And there was a question, the answer was it was a gun. Mr. Gregory asked, can you describe it? Note, subject said, and this is what Marina said, subject said, I cannot describe it, because a rifle to me, like all rifles. That was translated by Peter Gregory as follows. Now again, Marina says, subject said, I cannot describe it, because a rifle to me, like all rifles. That was translated by Peter Gregory. She said she cannot describe it. It was sort of a dark rifle, just like any other common rifle. That's a mistranslation, and mistranslated in such a way as to coincide with Gregory's friend Mamontov's translation 2 days earlier. Again, proceeding with the transcript. Question. Can you describe this rifle that you saw? Mr. Gregory in Russian. Same size as they are showing to you? In other words, he didn't translate the question right either. Mr. Gregory in Russian, same size as they are showing to you? Subject, I think so, but. Gregory translation. Again, Marina says, I think so, but. Gregory translation. She says that a rifle approximately the same length as you were showing her, however, the stock was longer. Obviously, that's not what Marina said. Subject in Russian. It was a humper elevation, but I never saw through the telescope. But it was the same kind of hump or elevation. And then Gregory translates this. She says there was an elevation on the rifle, but there was no scope. No telescope. Question, would you recognize a rifle scope if you saw one? Answer, yes. She says that she now knows the difference between a rifle with a scope and one without a scope. She says, until she saw the rifle with a scope on TV the other day, she did not know that rifles with scopes existed. So obviously Peter Gregory is mistranslating what Marina said in substantial ways, although they might appear trivial at first. Again, Marina says, in response to describing the rifle, subject said, I cannot describe it because a rifle to me, like all rifles, Gregory mistranslate that. She said she cannot describe it. It was sort of a dark rifle, just like any other common rifle. And Marina says, when asked, can you describe this rifle that you saw? And Gregory asks her, same size as they are showing you? And or showing to you? Marina says, I think so, but... And Gregory translates that. She says that a rifle approximately the same length as you were showing her, however, the stock was longer. And then Marina says, it was a hump or elevation, but I never saw through the telescope, but it was the same kind of hump or elevation. Gregory translates that. She says there was an elevation on the rifle, but there was no scope, no telescope. And these distortions are curious because, again, Peter Gregory is filling in the same details that were carried in Ilya Mamontov's interview 2 days earlier, or translated by Mamontov, and which will figure in the attempts by this white Russian, Galen-related, petroleum-related milieu to generate a Soviet conspiracy misinformation. This appears to have been part of the cover-up, necessitating in the minds of some investigators a cover-up to prevent World War III. Peter Dale Scott then goes on to comment, even if we knew no more than what has been said, this transcript would appear to constitute prima facie evidence of a cover-up conspiracy. Mr. Gregory had not been present at the first interview, and in theory at least, he knew nothing about the rifle and its color. How then, if not by conspiracy, did Gregory supply the seemingly innocuous word dark, which Marina had not used, and to which so much attention had been paid on November 22nd? In fact, the word was not so innocuous. On November 22nd, it was reported that the Dallas authorities would arrest Oswald, quote, as part of an international conspiracy, unquote, and Marina's first interview was, quote, interpreted, unquote, and reported in such a way as to strengthen that impression. Now, the dark figures in here because that supposedly, the use of the word dark was one way that Marina was able to recognize the rifle as having belonged to Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union, and as Mamontov, who translated the 1122 interview, as he points out, this meant that Oswald has to have been functioning as a KGB agent, said no ordinary person would have a gun in the Soviet Union. So the dark color is a key to the generation of misinformation that Oswald was functioning on behalf of KGB. The account on 11-22-63, again, that Oswald would be arrested as part of an international conspiracy, is as follows. Marina Oswald advised that Lee Harvey Oswald owned a rifle which he used in Russia about 2 years ago. She observed what she presumed to be the same rifle in a blanket in the garage at 2515 West 5th, Irving, the Payne residence. By the way, bear in mind that blanket, we're going to come back to it. On November 22, 1963, she observed the same blanket in the garage, but the rifle was missing. Marina Oswald stated that on November 22, 1963, she had been shown a rifle in the Dallas Police Department, reportedly found at the Texas School Book Depository, and was unable to positively identify it as the one she had observed in the above-mentioned garage. She stated that it was a dark color, like the one she had seen, but she did not recall the sight. So again, the last sentence again. She stated that it was a dark color, like the one she had seen, i.e. in the Soviet Union, but she did not recall the sight. Scott then goes on to comment, like Ilya Mamontov, Gregory's friend, who was the interpreter at the first interview, later went on television to argue that the assassination was an international communist conspiracy. His case was plausible. As Mamontov himself explained to the Warren Commission, no ordinary person, quote, had a gun in the Soviet Union, unquote, nor would he be allowed one. Mamontov added no less than seven times under oath that Marina had used the word dark to describe Oswald's rifle on November 22nd. Her actual words to Gregory only 2 days later, quote, I cannot describe it because a rifle to me, like all rifles, unquote, suggests how much had been gained, as well as lost, in translation. Gregory's interpolation of the word dark can hardly have been coincidental or innocent. There was thus no excuse for Secret Service agent Leon Gopadze, G-O-P-A-D-Z-E, who in turn became Marina's interpreter, to report that Gregory's translation, quote, was faultless without deviation, and at no time was there any indication that Mr. Gregory was translating otherwise. The same Gopadze decided it would be, quote, beneficial, unquote, to use Gregory in his own first interview with Marina when she first said she had taken the picture of Oswald and the rifle, including the disputed scope. Later, the Warren Commission decided to use Gopadze and Gregory together as Marina's interpreters on September 6, 1964. Skipping down, the commission relied on Marina's testimony that the Carcano rifle, quote, was the fateful rifle of Lee Oswald, unquote, citing that even though it knew very well that as its counsel Norman Redlich wrote in a memo of February 28, 1964, quote, Marina has repeatedly lied to the Secret Service, the FBI, and this commission on matters which are of vital concern, unquote. It chose to ignore the abundant indications that Marina, faced with not-so-subtle threats of deportation back to the Soviet Union, frequently changed her story to meet the latest demands of her interviewers. So again, the dark color added spontaneously by Peter Gregory was a key element in permitting the authorities or elements involved in this assassination to circulate the myth that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting on behalf of the Soviets, because again, no, the dark color and the lack of a sight was cited as proof that Marina had seen the rifle in the Soviet Union belonging to Lee Oswald, and as Mamontov, helping to generate the communist conspiracy disinformation, pointed out that no ordinary person would be allowed a rifle in the Soviet Union, skipping down again in Peter Dale Scott's essay. Before concluding that the Warren Commission were the chief culprits of the cover-up conspiracy, however, one has to consider that many constraints of time, budget, and of both public and bureaucratic policies on the scope of their inquiry. Rightly or wrongly, they saw their primary task as being, quote, to lay the dust, unquote, and the, quote, one lone nut hypothesis which they offered to the nation, even if not true, may have been less untrue and less harmful than Mamontov's alternative hypothesis of an international communist conspiracy. And again, there are indications that with the assassination of Stepan Bandera, preparations for that may have been underway even before Kennedy was elected. What we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at, again, this international communist conspiracy disinformation and how this White Russian Galen-related petroleum intelligence milieu functioned in connection with Army intelligence and Army Reserve intelligence in the events of 11-22-63, and there are firm indications of a conspiracy linking these same elements with elements of Army Reserve intelligence and Army intelligence functioning in both Dealey Plaza and inside of the Dallas PD and in the Secret Service. Now, remember, well, I'll sum up the information here afterward. Proceeding with the government documents in the JFK assassination. First names we're going to hear are Senkel and Turner, two Dallas policemen who, as indicated here, were at all of the critical areas vis-a-vis the assassination. And Peter Dale Scott writes, Senkel and Turner are among the couple of dozen policemen who on November 22nd and 24th managed to be at all the crucial scenes of action, often in the company of the Secret Service. And skipping down, before the assassination, Senkel and Turner were in the pilot car of the Kennedy motorcade, along with Deputy Chief George Lumpkin, L-U-M-P-K-I-N, who chose Mamontov to be Marina's interpreter and two alleged members of the Secret Service. So bear in mind, this is the pilot car in the Kennedy assassination, and it proceeds 3 minutes in front of the motorcade, and as we're going to see, it functioned in a very suspicious fashion. Now, Deputy Chief George Lumpkin, as we will see, is a member of Army Intelligence Reserve. Proceeding now with the account. In fact, these, quote, Secret Service personnel were Lieutenant Colonel George Whitmire, W-H-I-T-M-E-Y-E-R, a local Army Reserve commander, and Jack Puterbaugh, P-U-T-E-R-B-A-U-G-H, the local advance man for the Democratic National Committee who had helped fix the parade route in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Now Peter Dale Scott analyzes the pilot's car's behavior. The pilot car's behavior on November 22nd is certainly suspicious. Driving, quote, about 3 minutes ahead of the motorcade, unquote, the pilot car made one recorded stop along the parade route exactly in front of the Texas School Book Depository. And quoting from the commission's exhibits, Deputy Chief G.L. Lumpkin stopped momentarily at the corner of Houston and Elm Street, unquote, and spoke to the policeman, quote, working traffic at that corner, unquote. None of the three policemen assigned to that corner reported this conversation in their affidavits. One of them, J.M. Smith, did, however, report his part about 10 minutes earlier in the police request of 12:19 p.m., for an ambulance, quote, for a white male, for, quote, a white male who had an epileptic seizure, unquote. 8 pages of police radio Channel 1 transcript at the precise period of the assassination relate to this, quote, emergency, unquote, and the need to open a route directly and exactly to Parkland Hospital, quote, cut all traffic for the ambulance going to Parkland, unquote. Not for the president, who was shot only midway through this, quote, emergency, unquote, but for the man with the so-called, quote, epileptic seizure, unquote. The commission later learned, but did not report, that the man who walked away from the ambulance at Parkland had not had an epileptic seizure at all. Considering that Deputy Chief Lumpkin in the pilot car was, I have been reliably informed, a member of the Army Intelligence Reserve, and considering that the pilot car also contained the local Army Reserve commander as an unscheduled occupant, it is intriguing to learn that a bystander at the scene of the, quote, epileptic seizure, unquote, in Dealey Plaza was an Army intelligence agent, James W. Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. Now, to bear in mind that this person did not actually have an epileptic seizure, but that as a result for this alleged epileptic seizure, the guy later walked away. The path was cleared to Parkland Hospital, and by the way, it was at Parkland Hospital where the so-called magic bullet was found under, not on, but under Kennedy's stretcher. And we're going to find out more now about James Powell. Bear in mind, this pilot car stops in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Deputy Chief Lumpkin, a member of Army Intelligence Reserve, a passenger in his car, a local Army Reserve commander, and right there at the site of the epileptic seizure, James W. Powell, an Army intelligence agent, who happens to get locked or trapped inside the Texas School Book Depository when that depository is sealed on the order of Deputy Chief Lumpkin, again, Army Intelligence Reserve. Continuing with with government documents and the JFK assassination. Special Agent Powell was soon afterwards, quote, trapped inside the Texas School Book Depository after the depository doors had been sealed, unquote. The man who had ordered the Texas School Book Depository sealed was Lumpkin, who had driven there with Lieutenant Colonel Whitmire, Senkel, Turner, and Dallas Secret Service Chief Sorrells. Skipping down, as many as three Army intelligence agents may have figured in the events surrounding the Kennedy assassination. Alternatively, one or both of the two, quote, other agents may have been Powell. There was the Army intelligence agent who, with a member of the alcohol tax unit, spent the morning of November 22nd with James Hosty, the FBI agent whose name was in Oswald's notebook, and who reportedly described Oswald to Dallas Police Lieutenant Revel as, quote, a member of the Communist Party capable of committing the assassination, unquote. And there was the, quote, Army intelligence man, unquote, whom, quote, Lieutenant Revel knew, unquote, and drove back to his office from the Texas School Book Depository shortly before Revel encountered Hosty. This agent may well have been Powell, since Revel had organized the search of the Texas School Book Depository, which discovered the famous rifle on the sixth floor, where Powell, along with Lumpkin, was present. Whoever he was, Revel omitted his name when testifying under oath as to the occupants of his car. Until recently, it might have seemed unwarranted to see anything conspiratorial in this convergence of Army intelligence personnel on Dealey Plaza. But on May 16, 1973, the day before the first of the Senate Watergate hearings, which would help drive President Nixon from office, Army intelligence declassified an extraordinary Army telegram about Oswald dispatched late in the evening of November 22, 1963. The cable from the 4th Army Command in Texas to the U.S. Strike Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida linked Oswald to Cuba via the latter's communist, quote, propaganda vehicle, unquote, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. It also gave two statements about Oswald, both false, which had an interesting source. Don Stringfellow, S-T-R-I-N-G-F-E-L-L-O-W, Intelligence Section, Dallas Police Department, notified 112th Intelligence Group, this headquarters, that information obtained from Oswald revealed he had defected to Cuba in 1959 and is a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. Scott goes on to add, Stringfellow was a member of the police intelligence unit headed by Jack Revel, while the 4th Army's 112th Intelligence Group, with offices in Dallas and New Orleans, was the unit of James Powell. Bear in mind, James Powell, Army intelligence on the site of the, quote, epileptic seizure, then gets sealed inside the Texas School Book Depository where the rifle gets found. He may have been the agent who was with James Hosty, Oswald's FBI contact. He may also have been the agent who knew Lieutenant, or who knew Revel. And it was Revel who ordered the search of the Texas School Book Depository where Powell and Lumpkin, sealed in the building, helped come up with the Mannlicher Carcano. And note, too, that, again, Stringfellow of Rebel's intelligence section, and we're going to take a look at who heads that, is apparently notifies the 112th Intelligence Group that Oswald defected to Cuba in 59. That's not true, nor was he a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. And note that the Painting Oswald red here was done in this particular memo, this dispatch, and it was this painting of Oswald red involved Oswald's efforts on behalf of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now, we took a look at Oswald, the quote, Castro activist, unquote, in the Guns of November Part 1, as well as Radio Free America number 12. Oswald was the only member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which was housed in the same building as Guy Bannister's right-wing detective agency, which functioned basically they were at alternate addresses, which functioned as a unit of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban operation, and which was deeply involved in right-wing activities. 544 Camp Street was the site of the CIA's Cuban Revolutionary Council for a couple of years in the early 60s, and there are substantive indications, and again, Guns of November, Radio Free America Part 12, or Number 12, I should say, goes into the almost certain continued use of Guy Bannister's detective agency by the CIA's anti-Castro effort. But again, Stringfellow and the 112th Intelligence Group, Stringfellow working for Rebel, 112th Intelligence Group is Powell. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's analysis, U.S. STRICOM, the U.S. Strike Command, is an extraordinary two-service command, Army and Air Force, set up in 1961 in response to the so-called Lebanon crisis of 1958. Designed to provide a swift strike force on short notice, its location in Florida made it singularly appropriate for a surprise attack on Cuba. Since mid-1963, its commander had been General William D. Rawson, R-O-S-S-O-N, a CIA general who in 1954 had formed part of General Lansdale's team in Vietnam. Fletcher Prouty, in his book The Secret Team, lists him as one of the six who, quote, made rapid promotions to the grade of brigadier general and higher as a result of the CIA Special Forces and Vietnam, unquote. There is a flavor of 7 days in May to this cable of November 22nd, which U.S. STRICOM, again, it's USSTRICOM intelligence requested, since the distribution list, although confusing, suggests that it may not have reached headquarters in Washington until 4 days later. All of these facts add some interest to the unusual fashion in which Mamontov was recruited for the first interview about the, quote, dark and scopeless rifle, unquote. I have already mentioned that he was phoned by Deputy Chief Lumpkin, again, Army Intelligence Reserve, but the initial contact with Mamontov had been made 2 minutes earlier by Jack Alston Crichton, C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, a right-wing Republican, oil operator, member of Army Intelligence Reserve, and, quote, head of a local Army Intelligence Unit, unquote. Crichton knew Mamontov personally as a fellow petroleum geologist like Gregory. He also knew him because Mamontov was a precinct chairman of the Republican Party, for which Crichton became the 1964 candidate for governor of Texas. It is not known how many Dallas policemen were also, as is apparently a widespread practice, members of the U.S. Army Reserve. One such reservist was Detective Adamczyk, A-D-A-M-C-I-K, a member of the party which retrieved the rifle blanket from the Payne garage and later reported what he overheard at Mamontov's interview of Marina about the Carcano. Quote, she said that it looked like her husband's rifle. She said that it was dark, unquote. Now bear in mind that empty blanket in the Payne garage was cited in the 1122 report that talked about the dark rifle and the dark color being used to indicate that in fact Marina had seen that rifle owned by Lee in the Soviet Union and that therefore this was a communist conspiracy. Proceeding. Another member of Army Intelligence Reserve was Captain W. P. Gannaway, G-A-N-N-A-W-A-Y, Revel's supervisor as head of the Dallas Police Special Service Bureau. Gannaway's secretary was reported by an out-of-town police chief to be, quote, closely connected, unquote, to Jack Ruby. This story was plausible, given the close connections between Jack Ruby and the SSB, including men who participated in the search of the Texas School Book Depository and the arrest of Oswald. Very important sentence coming up. Now, bear in mind, this Rebel is the fellow for whom Stringfellow works. That's the guy who communicated with 112th Intelligence, of which James Powell is a member. Captain W.P. Gannaway heads the Dallas Police Intelligence Unit. He's Rebel's supervisor. Rebel organizes the search of the school book depository, which finds the Mannlicher Carcano. After Lumpkin seals it and James Powell is in there of the 112th Intelligence Group, lo and behold, the Carcano turns up. W.P. Ganaway is a member of Army Intelligence Reserve. He's Rebel's supervisor, and his role is as follows. Since the protection of visiting dignitaries was one of the SSB's responsibilities, Ganaway was involved in the meetings arranged by Secret Service advance man Lawson for the Kennedy visit. Moreover, Winston Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N, the White House Secret Service agent responsible for the choice of the Kennedy motorcade route, was himself a member of the Army Intelligence Reserve. Lawson's first three reports of what happened on and before November 22nd raised considerable questions about his performance. For example, he, along with another Secret Service agent, reported that motorcycles were used on, quote, the right and left flanks of the president's car, unquote, although numerous later reports from the Dallas police agreed that, quote, at Lawson's own instructions, the proposed side escorts were redeployed to the rear of the car. This change, ostensibly for the sake of security, would appear to leave the president more open to a possible crossfire. And skipping down, events since the Kennedy assassination have alerted us to the possibility of illicit collaboration between members of Army intelligence and the Secret Service. In 1970, the Washington Star reported that, quote, plainclothes military intelligence agents played a questionable and still secret surveillance role at the 1968 National Conventions, unquote, in Chicago, where the Secret Service admitted borrowing agents from the Illinois-based 113th Intelligence Group. These borrowed, quote, security, unquote, forces conducted extensive domestic intelligence operations, and there were rumors of provocations as well. In 1972, there were similar rumors about the 1972 party conventions and the 111th Intelligence Group in Miami, where one provocateur, Pablo Fernandez, was said to be a former CIA agent working with Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt. What we know from these later disturbances suggests that it is now common practice for the Secret Service, whose local offices are scantily staffed, to augment their staff for special events with auxiliary personnel from military intelligence and other sources. Quite by accident, we know that the Dallas Secret Service recruited 30 men from the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce Sports Committee, of whom the informant at least was a former Army Air Force intelligence officer, to, quote, assist the Secret Service at the breakfast for President Kennedy, unquote, on November 22nd. In Dallas, where Adlai Stevenson had been attacked only 1 month earlier, one would expect the Secret Service, which gave special attention to this event, to have recruited even more such auxiliaries. Yet the reports and testimony of Lawson and other Secret Service agents are silent on this score. Meanwhile, the FBI reported that its offer of assistance had been declined. Skipping down, we recognized earlier that the political constraints which made it difficult for the Warren Commission, which had questionable constitutional authority and no independent investigative staff, to pursue the documentary indications of a possible conspiracy linking Army intelligence and the local Dallas police, who engaged Mamontov as interpreter, to the Secret Service, who engaged Gregory. Now, again, quickly summing up what we've looked at here. Gregory mistranslates what Marina said to reinforce what Mamontov translated 2 days earlier, 11:22. That mistranslation, the dark color and the scopeless rifle, lends credence to what Mamontov and others are trying to disseminate, namely that Lee Harvey Oswald owned the rifle in the Soviet Union and that Marina had identified it there. This indicated that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting as an agent of an international conspiracy. Now, Deputy Chief Lumpkin of Army Intelligence Reserve recruits Mamontov, but after the initial contact is made by Jack Alston Crichton, again, a part of the DeGolyer and McNaughton orbit, like Declan Ford and like George Bowie, who we looked at earlier, also of Army Intelligence Reserve, he's the first to contact Mamontov. Deputy Chief Lumpkin is in the pilot car, which stops conveniently right in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Army intelligence agent James Powell is there where a guy has an epileptic seizure. Lumpkin is Army Intelligence Reserve. In the pilot car is Lieutenant Colonel George Whitmire of Army Intelligence. The clearing of the path for this, quote, epileptic seizure permits a direct path for Kennedy's car to go to Parkland Hospital. Agent James Powell is then sealed inside the Texas School Book Depository, that's Army Intelligence Agent James Powell, by Deputy Chief Lumpkin of Army Intelligence Reserve. Then Lieutenant Revel of the Dallas SSB organizes a search of the Texas School Book Depository where, with Lumpkin and Powell, the rifle, the Mannlicher Carcano, is found. A Dallas cop named Stringfellow notifies the Army 112th Intelligence Group, of which James Powell is a member, that Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist linked with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and having defected to Cuba, was behind this assassination. Now, bear in mind also that there were one and possibly three Army intelligence agents connected both to Revel and to James Hostie, Oswald's FBI contact. Bear in mind that the Special Intelligence Unit, the SSB, of the Dallas PD, for which Revel and Stringfellow work, is headed up by W.P. Ganaway of Army Intelligence Reserve, his secretary reportedly close to Jack Ruby, and that he, that is to say Ganaway of AIR, is working with Winston Lawson of the Washington Secret Service Detail to plan the route of the motorcade, and Winston Lawson is of Army Intelligence Reserve, and that it is Winston Lawson who, according to the Dallas police records, deployed the two motorcycles that were to be alongside of Kennedy's limousine to the rear, thereby exposing him or making him more vulnerable to a crossfire. Bear in mind also that a Detective Adamczyk, A-D-A-M-C-I-K, who was there when the rifle blanket was found in the Payne's garage, that, again, of course, was in Marina's description, or the alleged description by Marina on 11-22-63, pointing to an international conspiracy. Detective Adamczyk is also Army Reserve. And also, bear in mind that the attack on Adlai Stevenson, which we're going to come back to in a little bit, the attack on Adlai Stevenson necessitated, in the minds of the Secret Service and Dallas PD, the recruiting of 30 men from the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce, and there are unexplained Secret Service people, skipping down just a little bit in what I've already read. The Warren Commission, faced with reports and rumors of unexplained additional, quote, Secret Service, unquote, on the grassy knoll, with Lumpkin behind the Texas School Book Depository, in front of the Texas School Book Depository, and even at the tip at Killing, asked no questions and learned nothing. So again, with Crichton, with Mamontov, and with Gregory, we're looking at this petroleum intelligence milieu, of which George Bush was a part, and we're looking at it at the operational level, apparently in conjunction with elements of Army Intelligence and Army Reserve Intelligence, bridging Secret Service and Dallas PD. It's Crichton who engages Mamontov, and then Mamontov is referred to Lumpkin. Now, I realize this is complicated, but this is by way of looking at this milieu, this liberation, Galen-connected, petroleum-connected milieu, at the hands-on operational level. As I said, we're looking at it on Elm Street, and now in order to understand the larger political and economic forces at whose behest, or on whose behalf they were operating, we're going to begin dollying back, and we're going to begin to traverse up the American political and economic hierarchy, as well as the national security hierarchy, and we're going to move from Elm Street to Wall Street. After a musical break, more of Radio Free America 37.